DW Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum. My name is Connor Dillon. We have got a jam-packed show today filled with stories about how we human beings interact with animals, both on a personal and also a biological level. But before we get into all that goodness, here is a quick health tip to start things off right, told here by my colleague Zulfikar Abani, and it will be especially useful to any of you who know someone who goes on business trips.
Your business trips might be making you sick. People who travel for business at least 2 weeks per month are at higher risk of developing diseases linked to lifestyle factors. This was discovered by researchers who studied the health and travel records of more than 18,000 employees. People traveling frequently for work appear to have more symptoms of anxiety and depression, as well as sleeping difficulties. They also seemed more likely to smoke, consume alcohol, and to live a sedentary lifestyle. The researchers suggest that if you travel a lot, you should make sure to keep a healthy diet, exercise regularly, watch your alcohol consumption, and get enough sleep.
Get enough sleep. Well, that might be a bit difficult at the moment for residents just outside of Oslo, Norway. They are increasingly worried about a growing population of wolves that are roaming around the countryside. But a new government plan to eliminate many of those wolves has also brought a sort of counter-reaction, and it has highlighted a sociological split in the way Norwegians view their wolf companions. Lars Bevenger has more from Norway.
I've just driven a few minutes from Oslo city centre, and I'm immediately in the deepest forests surrounding the capital. I thought I'd go for a quick cross-country ski run. Now, even this close to the city, it feels wild here, and it really can be. There have been several sightings of wolves not far from here. That might sound exciting and exotic to many, but not all are thrilled with the lupine presence, be it here near the capital city or elsewhere in the country, where nearly 60 wolves roam.
People are very frustrated. They feel like they have been deprived of the right to do farming, to use the forests for hunting, because the wolves are keeping the moose population down, so the quotas for hunting are less.
Emilia Enger Mehl is an MP for the Agrarian Centre Party. Their power base is rural communities, which are typically the ones where wolves are seen as a problem, not a resource.
They feel like they have been deprived of a safe environment for living, because when there are wolf presence, you are more careful to let your children play freely and to use nature as freely as they could do before.
Do you feel there is no place for wolves in Norway, or could they in some way coexist if they were managed better?
If I were to decide on my own, I would say that the wolf does not belong in Norway.
Wolves have not attacked humans in modern times in Norway, but they do kill sheep that often roam free in the summer months. In order to keep such damage to a minimum, the government each year sets a quota for the culling of wolves.
My name is Ingrid Lomelde, and I'm the policy director of WWF Norway. In Norway, we have a wolf population of about 56 wolves. Every year we have increased hunting quotas for wolves in Norway, even though they're listed as critically endangered and almost extinct from Norwegian nature.
Just before Christmas last year, the government opened up for the culling of 42 wolves this season, which Ingrid Lomelde and WWF Norway say is the equivalent of 90% of the country's total wolf population. WWF will now take the Norwegian state to court over its predatory animal management policies. Last week, the environmental organisation lost another court challenge aimed at halting the current cull until their main case will be heard.
We see that this increasing number of hunting licences is actually conflicting with our international commitments of helping the wolf rise to a non-endangered status on the red list. So that's why we've decided to ask the courts in Norway to do a thorough run-through of how the predatory animals practices are done to see whether these quotas are in fact in adherence with national and international laws. And we actually don't think they are. We really don't think it's acceptable to have a situation where we have a state management hunt that keeps the wolf on the brink of extinction like it does today.
The government argues it is acting on the advice of biologists and says it always ensures there is still a viable wolf population left after each cull. People living near wolf packs say the annual cull often does not go far enough. Karianne Lundgaard is a lawyer working for a law firm representing an association of some 90 rural municipalities in Norway.
In one of our municipalities, the mayor believes that people don't want to move there because they have a wolf pack which is close to kindergartens, to where school children go to school, and also wolf packs who move in residential areas. And that, of course, affects the way that people use the nature in their daily lives.
Now, people's opinions on wolves tend to be divided between people who live more in the countryside and those that live in the city, with the latter typically more prone to want to protect the wolves.
They belong in the nature. They have been there for, I don't know how long, but they definitely belong here.
I think they should be left in peace. Yeah, they're part of our culture.
I'm not so sure because I feel sorry for the farmers who have the sheep, but I also feel sorry for the wolf.
WWF will see the Norwegian state in court later this year. If the environmentalists get their way, Norway must re-evaluate how its wolf population is managed. But for many of the animals roaming the forests around here and elsewhere in the country, it might already be too late. Hunting season is already well underway. Lars Bevanger, DW, Oslo.
So, should those wolves be killed? Or should they be allowed to roam free and reproduce? We would love to hear your thoughts. We're at spectrum@dw.com. Being stressed, unfortunately, seems to be just one of those default human settings for 21st century adults. But there are ways to actually reduce stress in your body, and not just at the cognitive level, which is good, but also at the physiological level. Here is Zulfi Karabani again with some interesting new research, so get your nose ready.
Stressed? Give your partner's t-shirt a sniff. It might sound a bit disgusting, but smelling your partner's clothing when you're stressed can actually help you to relax. This was shown in a recent study by researchers at the University of British Columbia in Canada. Many people wear their partner's shirt or sleep on their partner's side of the bed when their partner is away, but may not realise why they engage in these behaviours, says Marlies Hofer, the study's lead author. For women, a partner's scent alone seems to be enough to reduce stress significantly. A stranger's scent, on the other hand, seems to raise levels of the stress hormone cortisol. Globalization means that people have to travel for work or work in different cities entirely, say the researchers. So simply taking a piece of your loved one's clothing when they're away can help you reduce stress when you're apart.
And of course, just make sure you know you clear it all ahead of time with your partner before you take their clothes on that business trip of yours or other trip of yours. Otherwise, you might have to answer some questions later. Now, on to some more fresh research. Apes, crows, elephants, dolphins. We now know that they are much more intelligent than we used to think that they were in the past, and we know that due to scientific research and careful observation. But there's still one group of vertebrates that's been relatively neglected in terms of cognition research for quite some time, and that's fish. Recent experiments, though, show they're anything but dumb, and in some tests, they even outperform apes, which I find incredible. Our reporter, Brigitte Osterath, a big fish enthusiast herself, set out to find out more with the story told here by Gudrun Heise.
Charles, a peacock-eyed stingray, waits impatiently behind a closed gate in his aquarium. Soon the gate will open and he'll see two cards with different patterns on it. He'll have to decide which card to swim to. because only one card will lead to those delicious shrimps. But which one?
Our
rays are really clever. They're incredibly motivated and eager. You get the feeling that they enjoy those experiments. They're the most motivated species we have here. The cichlids are also great participants. The sharks, though, they're a little bit lazy. We always have to push them a bit.
A lot of people train their dogs. Vera Schlüssel trains her fish. She's a biologist at Bonn University and researches learning behavior and cognition in rays, sharks and bonyfish. To find out what fish can or can't learn, Schlüssel uses one simple method.
We always offer two stimuli. For example, one card with horizontal stripes and one with vertical stripes. And we always give them a reward for just one of them. So in the beginning, the animal swims to both cards at a rate of 50-50, more or less. But if it can see a difference and if it can learn, it will soon start to prefer the card which is associated with food. That goes without saying. And then we know that the animal has learnt the concept.
Dementsprechend dann wissen wir, dass das eben gelernt wurde.
So far, Vera Schlüssel has taught her fish to distinguish between photographs of fish and photographs of snails. They can also differentiate between squares and triangles. The animals have additionally learned to swim to the card with a higher amount of objects on it, proving that fish do have a kind of numerical comprehension. Right now, Vera Schlüssel's bachelor student is trying to find out if rays can learn to discriminate vertical from horizontal stripes and just how small those stripes can be before the recognition fails. While working with the animals, Schlüssel and her team have come to know the individual fish quite well and vice versa.
Ich kenne auf jeden Fall die Person, die den ganzen Tag mit ihnen arbeitet.
The fish can recognize for sure the person who works with them all day and can tell him or her apart from other people. That's 100% certain. When I worked with those rays back then, they knew it was feeding time when I arrived and they got very excited. When somebody else turned up instead, nothing happened.
No one would doubt that dogs and cats can recognize their owners just by looking at them. With fish, it's a different story, though. In 2016, researchers in Brisbane, Australia, showed that archerfish can distinguish between human faces. Many people were surprised at that result. Archerfish prey on land-based insects by shooting them down with water jets from their mouths. The researchers had trained those fish to shoot at photos of humans instead and gave them food when they hit the right person. The fish learned quickly which faces were the right ones, even when the researchers changed the color or brightness of the photos or even the head shape of the pictured people. But why did we think that fish couldn't tell apart human faces? Here's Jonathan Balcombe, US biologist and author of the book What a Fish Knows.
We tend to have a dimmer view of fishes than all the other animals with backbones. Certainly mammals and birds we hold in higher esteem. And I think there's a number of reasons why we may think that the fishes are just dumb creatures. They don't blink. They don't need to blink. They have those staring eyes, but their eyes are bathed in water all the time, so they never needed to evolve eyelids. They also make sounds underwater, many of them, but we don't hear them in the air. So they don't trigger some of our sympathy, I think.
Even if we could hear the sounds that fish make, it wouldn't help much to improve the intellectual picture we have of them. This, for example, is a red-bellied piranha from the Amazon. And this is a female croaking gourami from Southeast Asia courting a male she likes. Over the last 15 years, fish cognition research has seen incredible advances. More and more scientists like Vera Schlüssel in Bonn investigate what these underwater animals are actually capable of and have seen amazing results. One new discovery is that fish can use tools, which was observed when a black-spot tuskfish in Palau took a bivalve in its mouth, swam several meters away and catapulted the food several times towards a rock until it cracked open. Stingrays also used water as a tool to get food from a plastic tube inside their aquarium, an international researcher team found. In general, we should rethink our image of fish, Balcom says.
They can pretty much do whatever mammals can do. Animals with fur, if they can do it, then some kind of fishes is probably doing it as well. This shouldn't surprise us. We tend to be hierarchical in how we think of cognitive skill. But animals are, if it's useful to them, if it's important for their survival, they will evolve solutions to the problem and they will become very good at doing those cognitive things.
Like the cleaner rats, researchers presented the animals with two bowls of food. After a short while, the blue one was taken away, leaving just the red one. So which one should a clever fish eat from first? The blue bowl, leaving the red one for later, since it will be there anyway. The fish learned this concept quite fast. Primates, though, never got their heads around it. At Bonn University, the peacock-eye stingray Charles has found his way to the cart with horizontal stripes on it and is rewarded with a shrimp. But now Vera Schlissel's bachelor student tries the experiment with stripes that are much smaller than before, and Charles fails. She asks Schlissel what the reason might be.
Und das geht auch nicht?
Das geht.
This card doesn't work either? It does. Then they have understood the concept, but the resolution of their eyes is maybe not good enough. You should try with stripes just a little bit smaller than before.
Dann haben sie das Prinzip verstanden. Dann liegt es tatsächlich an der Auflösung.
Yes, it is a kind of detective work, Schlüssel says, but small experiments like this one at Bonn University can help to revolutionize the way we think about fish. Because after all, you don't need to have arms or eyelids to be a brainiac.
Sticking to fish for now. In the North Sea, Dutch researchers have been trying out a new fishing method that they say is better than traditional beam trawling methods that end up doing irreparable damage to marine environments. The EU Parliament, however, has just voted to ban this new method, which involves electricity. Karin Bench has this report, told here by Carla Bleicher, on the pros and cons of pulse fishing.
It was a long and complicated vote, and by the end of it, the winners were the opponents of a fishing tactic called pulse fishing. A majority in European Parliament voted to ban the use of electric fishing in the European Union. But since pulse fishing occurs in just a small section of the North Sea, and since it involves just a tiny percentage of the fishing fleet there, the vote was regrettable, says EU parliamentarian Ulrike Rodust. The Social Democrat from Northern Germany says the current pulse fishing operations are primarily aimed at evaluating the new method scientifically.
Man wollte weiter forschen. Ich halte das für sinnvoll.
They wanted to keep researching. I find that sensible because in the past it's been shown that in areas where pulse fishing took place, with crab fishing, for example, there was markedly less bycatch.
Weniger Beifänge waren.
With pulse fishing, fish and crabs on the seafloor are jolted with electric nets and are then caught. The advantage of this kind of fishing is that the nets hover over the seafloor instead of flying just above it. That differentiates the new practice from other large-scale fishing operations that routinely use heavy nets. Professor Adrian Reinstorp from the Dutch University of Wageningen has been researching the effects of pulse fishing over the last 3 years.
The disturbance of the seafloor is 50% less than the disturbance by the traditional tickler chain beam trawl gear.
The opponents of pulse fishing worry, however, that the technology could lead to an even greater depletion of fish stocks in the ocean, since the method is more effective. And they condemn the electric shock method as brutal. In some cases, the shocks cause extreme muscle cramps in larger, rounder fish, like the Atlantic cod, says Reinstorp.
They can break their bone due to this contraction of the muscles.
Among EU countries, attitudes towards pulse fishing vary greatly. The pioneers of the practice are the Dutch. They've been testing the method for more than 3 years, and they view it as a positive development. France, more than any other country, is against pulse fishing. The French have yet to implement any of the new pulse fishing technologies, and as a result, their fleets could be at a competitive disadvantage. In Brussels over the last few weeks, there's been a lot of lobbying from France, says EU parliamentarian Rodost.
The French don't have an ecological interest in the issue, rather a purely business-based interest. They didn't participate in the research. Their fleet is entirely without pulse fishing technologies, and as a result, economically speaking, they sustain greater losses.
Soon, three-way negotiations will begin between representative of EU countries, the EU Commission, and the European Parliament. There, fisheries ministers will also have a word, and many of them will argue in favor of the new practice, says Europarlamentarian Werner Kuhn of the Christian Democratic Party.
I think they'll be able to agree to continue with these research programs and to also equip 5% of the fleet with these methods of pulse fishing.
This summer, the results of the Dutch pulse fishing research are expected to be published. At that point, we'll be able to learn more about how dangerous or not dangerous electric fishing really is.
And that was Carla Bleicher with the story there by Karin Bench. So again, what do you think? Electric nets or no electric nets? Let us know. We're at spectrum@dw.com. Well, we've been talking about fish, and one of the best-known nutrients contained in fish meat is something called omega-3. Omega-3 is a fatty acid, and it's been really popular in the press for the last few years due to reports proclaiming its benefits for the heart, the human brain, and its ability to lower cholesterol. But if you don't eat fish, you can still get that omega-3 goodness. Here's Zulfikar Abani again with fresh research from Finland.
Camelina oil battles cholesterol levels. Camelina oil is one from the camelina plant, which is also known as false flax or gold of pleasure. The oil's most valuable characteristic is its extraordinarily high content of omega-3 fatty acids, which are beneficial to our health. They can, for example, help prevent cardiovascular diseases. Now, researchers at the University of Eastern Finland have discovered that camelina oil reduces LDL cholesterol, the bad cholesterol, in people with high blood sugar. The researchers found that taking a daily 30 milliliter dose of camelina oil for 12 weeks was enough to lower LDL cholesterol levels. At high levels, LDL cholesterol can accumulate in the blood vessels and cause blockages, increasing the risk of a heart attack. Camelina oil can be used as cooking oil for frying at high temperatures or as a dressing for salads.
Salad. Now, off to India, where a team of scientists have isolated a parasite from goat blood. And that parasite is responsible for something really nasty in human beings that causes their skin to turn black. It's called Kala Azar, and it's also called black fever or visceral leishmaniasis. The disease is transmitted by sandflies, so it's vector-borne, and discovering the parasites in goats has a few implications for treating it. Murali Krishnan has more from Delhi.
At the prestigious All India Institute of Medical Sciences in New Delhi, Dr. Sarnam Singh, the head of clinical microbiology, is hopeful of his next round of funding after painstaking research of his team discovered that animals too were a reservoir for the parasite. He's been studying this parasitic disease that was confined to humans in the Indian subcontinent for decades and has helped make accurate and rapid diagnosis of this highly fatal disease.
Visceral leishmaniasis, or commonly what we know as Kala Azar, because it causes blackening of the skin. So Kala means black, Azar means fever. So black fever. And this is really almost 100% fatal if not treated.
But now Singh believes the elimination for Kala Azar, which currently focuses on treating people, will have to be re-looked at, with a special focus on animals. Last year, Singh stumbled upon evidence of the parasite in goats. It's still early to conclude whether it is a different strain of the virus, but its discovery could portend a new kind of treatment regime.
We did serological methods, and molecular tests, which are obviously more sensitive and more robust. And using these methods, we investigated more than 1,000 animals which were butchered, and the blood samples were collected. So we found that more than 10% of the goats, they were positive serologically.
India itself accounts for half the global burden of Kala Azar, which is endemic to the Indian subcontinent in 119 districts and in three other countries, Bangladesh, Bhutan, and Nepal. People get infected when bitten by an insect called the sandfly, which harbors the disease-causing parasite. Sandflies are small insects, about one-fourth of a mosquito. The infection first appears as a fever, before affecting the spleen, the liver, and causing the skin to turn black. Initially, it is often misdiagnosed as malaria. If untreated, Kala Azar can kill within 2 years of the onset of the ailment, though the availability of a range of drugs for almost a century has meant that less than 1 in 1,000 now succumbs to the disease. But this new finding opens up new and potentially dangerous possibilities. Dr. Singh again.
We found that in one of the animals, we could isolate the parasite, so which looks like Leishmania, and we are maintaining it. And the interesting thing is that this was a very, very big finding for us, for the country as such. We are trying to find out the genetic differences if this Leishmania isolated from the goat is same as we find in the humans, or it is different.
Abhinav Grover, a scientist from the School of Biotechnology, has been researching vector-borne diseases. He believes a different strain could lead to drug resistance.
Parasite is smarter, so it will start mutating itself and it might lead to drug resistance after a while. So we also need to do more research so that we are able to patch up with the way parasite is multiplying and changing its genome.
Kala Azar was always presumed to be anthropognathic in India and the subcontinent, meaning the disease-causing agent was carried by humans and could be transferred to animals. This marks the first successful attempt to identify an animal reservoir host, or a zoonotic disease, transmitted between species from animals to humans. Dr. Singh says further research will hold the key to how to treat the disease.
If it is established that this strain is same as found in the humans, then we will also be in the same boat as whole world. So this will again be called zoonotic, and in that case, it will be really very important for any program manager that we should also consider animals as a reservoir, and before we declare Kala Azar eliminated or eradicated, we must screen animals also.
Sukriti Goyal, another scientist, believes the finding is a cause for concern.
If it is spreading its transmission and reservoirs among animals apart from humans, I think it is a cause of worry. I think if it is now being found in animals, the rate of spread might increase in India.
In the early 1990s, the disease used to claim several thousands of lives each year. The numbers have reduced significantly, but India is still far away from eliminating Kala Azar. In European countries and Brazil, the parasite has been found in dogs. Now, there'll be a need to screen animals infected with the disease, apart from treating people suffering from it. Murali Krishnan, DW, New Delhi.
Animals as a repository for diseases that affect humans, always an interesting and kind of frightening topic worthy of more research. Well, that's it from me, Connor Dillon. I'd like to take a moment to thank my technician, Gert Georgi, for producing this show, and to thank all of our listeners out there for spending some of your time with me this week. I hope you've learned something that'll make you happier or healthier or better prepared for the future, or better yet, you know what, how about all of the above? On behalf of all my SciTech colleagues here at DW, have a wonderful week ahead.